Having discussed with you yesterday basic principles of what Zen is about, I'm passing on today to the more practical side of it. And this morning I'm going to discuss how Zen training is in a monastery and make various comments about it. And this afternoon I'm going to discuss the tea ceremony and actually do it, because it's easier to show what Zen is than to talk about it. I mean, if you want to get the hang of it. As I said yesterday, a Zen monastery is not a monastery in the Christian sense. It's more like a theological seminary, except that it practices more than it teaches. A typical institution consists of a campus. And on the campus there are many buildings. First of all, around the edges you will invariably find independent temples that were founded in times past by noble families. Because one of the things that the Buddhists did when they came to the Far East was they exploited ancestor worship. This was very clever of them. This being the great religion of China, the Buddhist priests performed services like requiem masses for the repose of the souls, or for good incarnation, reincarnations for one's ancestors, and they made quite a thing out of that. And so they have memorial services for the departed, and that's one of the principal functions of temples in Japan. People don't go to temple in the same way as Westerners go to church. They make pilgrimages to temples. And say, at a great temple like Eheiji, you will find on a Sunday morning, or practically any morning, a swarm of about 500 people attending the 4 a.m. service of chanting the Buddhist scriptures. But they are kind of in and out of their temples. They have special services, they have memorial services, weddings, all kinds of funerals, or everything like that. But they don't have a parish kind of church community as we find it in the West. Although when Buddhism, through the Japanese immigrants, exports itself to the United States, they immediately copy the Protestant church institution and sing, "Buddha loves me, this I know, for the sutra tells me so." It's terrible. And all the young men, Nisei, who have never been in Japan, the one thing they can't stand is sutra chanting, because they don't know what it means, and the priests don't know what it means a lot of the time. But it's beautiful to listen to, and they haven't got an educated Western ear yet to appreciate that kind of Oriental music. Well, now, then, aside from these many temples, each of which is in charge of a priest with his family, and some of them are having a hard time making a go of it these days, so they've become restaurants for very elegant food, or museums, and all sorts of things. Now the central, the guts of a Zen temple is what's called the Sodo. So in Japanese is the Sangha, the order of followers of the Buddha. Do simply means hall. So the Sangha hall, or Sodo, is the center. And this consists of a number of rooms, but the main one, the actual Sodo itself, is a large, long, spacious room with platforms on either side and a wide passage down the center. The platforms are 6 feet wide, and each contains a number of tatami mats, which are measure 6 by 3. And every monk is assigned to a mat. And on a shelf behind the mat against the wall, he has all his possessions, which are very simple. And so the mat is his sleeping place and his meditation place. There is an image of the Bodhisattva Manjusri in the hall, more or less in the center of the passage between the platforms. Manjusri is a Bodhisattva, they call him Monju in Japan, who holds in his hand a sword. And this sword is the sword of wisdom, or prajna, which cuts asunder all illusions. That is the dwelling place and the meditation place of the monks. And then they have, of course, kitchens and a library, and they have special temples that the monks use for various services. Then aside from that, there are the quarters of the kansho, who is the abbot or administrative head of the temple, and then the quarters of the roshi, who is the spiritual teacher. There isn't in the Zen, not in the Rinzai Zen school at any rate, exactly a hierarchy. Every temple is independent. There's no pope, no archbishop. But there is a fraternal relationship between all the temples of the Rinzai sect. The Soto sect have a little bit of a hierarchy, but still, on the whole, the kansho, or administrative head of the temple, is the big boss. The roshi is the respected boss, the man everybody's terrified of, at least on the outside, at any rate. Now, if you want to get into one of these institutions and study, they make it difficult. It's so different from the welcome attitude you get when you go into a Christian church. Here they repel you. Westerners, of course, are treated with a certain amount of courtesy that is not ordinarily accorded to Japanese. But even then, it's made difficult, because they realize that a Westerner who's taken the trouble to learn Japanese and to get himself over the oceans and to live under unfamiliar conditions is certainly pretty serious about it. And there are a number of Western Zen monks. So funny, there's one at Eheiji who comes from San Francisco, and he's tremendously tall. And to see him with all the others is quite amusing. Anyway, the formal approach is that you arrive in your traveling gear at the gate, and the Zen monk's traveling gear is most picturesque. He wears a great mushroom on his head, enormous straw hat, about so wide. And then he has a black robe, rather shorter than a kimono, and he has white, long white tabi socks underneath, and geta, which are the wooden sandals with bridges on them to keep you high up a bit. Or he may wear just plain waraji, which are straw sandals. And then he carries on the front his little box, in which are his eating bowls, his razor, his toothbrush, and such necessities of life. Well, when he arrives, he's told that the monastery is very poor, and they can't afford to take on any more students, and that the teacher is getting old, and it might tax his strength, and things like that. So he has to sit on the steps, and he puts his traveling box in front of him. He takes off his big hat, and he lays his head on the box, his forehead, and waits there all day. But he is invited in for meals to a special little guest house, because no traveling monk can be refused hospitality. And he is admitted at night into this special place, but he is expected not to sleep, but to spend all night in meditation. In olden times, this went on for at least a week or 10 days, to test this fellow out. Then finally, the assistant to the Roshi comes and tells him that the Roshi maybe would have a talk with him. So now you must remember the aspect of a Roshi to this young monk. He's a formidable fellow, usually an older man, who has about him something that is difficult to put your finger on. There's a certain fierceness, coupled with a kind of tremendous directness, a sense of somebody who sees right through you. And so he really poses to this young fellow, "What do you want? Why did you come here?" But he said, "I came to be instructed in Zen." The teacher says, "Well, we don't teach anything here. There isn't anything in Zen to study." Well, the student knows, or thinks he knows, that this not anything which is studied in Zen is the real thing. That's, of course, as a Buddhist, he knows that what isn't anything is the universe, the great void, the shunyata. And so he isn't fazed by that. He says, "Well, nevertheless, you do have people who are working here and meditating under your instruction, and I'd like to join them." "Well, maybe, but strictly on probation." And then, of course, all the details are taken. And he pays a ridiculously small fee, in modern Japan at any rate, to be able to stay in the monastery. It's very, very inexpensive. Now the teacher comes back and says, "Now you want to study Zen. Why?" "Well, because I'm oppressed by the rounds of birth and death, in other words, by the vicious circles of life in which I find myself, by suffering, by pain, and so on, and I want to be emancipated." The teacher says, "Who is it that wants to be emancipated?" Well, that's a stopper. There was a good old story about one of these preliminary interviews. The master asks, first of all, very casual questions. "Where's your hometown? What's your name? What did your father do? And where did you go to college? Why is my hand so much like the Buddha's hand?" And suddenly, you know, in midstream of an ordinary conversation, clunk, the student is blocked. And so there is devised the koan, K-O-A-N in Chinese, kung'an. And this means, literally, the word koan means a case, in exactly the same sense as we talk about a case in law which functions as a precedent for future cases. Koan should be translated case. The koans are based on stories, mondo, of the conversations between the old masters and their students. But you can make a koan immediately by such a question: "Why is my hand so much like the Buddha's hand?" Or, "Who are you that asked this question?" And if the student tries to verbalize on that and say, "Well, I am so-and-so," he asks, "Who knows that you're so-and-so? How do you know that you know? Who knows that you know? Find out." In other words, the basic koan is always, "Who are you? Who is it that wants to escape from birth and death?" And I won't take words for an answer. I want to see you. And all you're showing me at the moment is your mask. So then the student is sent back to the monk's quarters, the sodo. And the chief of the sodo is called the jikijitsu, is then put in charge of him. And he teaches him how to behave, what the rules are, how to eat, and how to meditate. In the Zen sect, they sit on padded cushion, About the thickness of the San Francisco telephone directory, which is an admirable substitute. And then, with crossed legs in the lotus posture, with the feet resting on the thighs, like you always see a Buddha, they sit for half-hour periods. That's supposed to be the length of time it takes for a stick of incense to burn. And then, when wooden clappers are knocked together, they all get up, and they walk round and round the room quite fast, at a kind of bum, 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 pace. And this keeps you awake. Then, at a given signal, they go back and meditate again. And constantly there is a monk, one on each side, carries a long, flat stick shaped almost like this fan, in the sense that it's thin at one end and rounded at the other. And if this guy sees a monk who is slouching or sleeping or goofing off in some way, he very respectfully bows before him, and the monk rests his head on his knees, and this fellow takes the stick and hits him vigorously on the shoulders, here, like this. Now, most apologists for Zen say, this is not punishment. It's simply to keep you awake. Don't you believe it? I've investigated this, and it's the same as the sort of British boys' school. Only it doesn't have the erotic qualities that the British floggings do. The Zen people are cool about it. But it is a kind of a fierce thing. Well, anyway, the point of the meditation, the zazen, is that perhaps at the beginning one does nothing more than count your breathing. So many breaths in counting in tens. Just to allow your thoughts to become still. Zen people do not close their eyes when they meditate, nor do they close their ears. They keep their eyes on the floor in front of them, and they don't try to force away any sounds that are going on, or any smell, or any sensation, whatever. Only they don't think about it. And this can become an extraordinarily pleasant occupation. All the little sounds of distant traffic, of birds, of somebody carpentering somewhere and a hammer going, dog barking, or especially rain on the roof. Gorgeous. They don't block that out. But as time goes on, instead of counting breathing, they devote themselves to the koan problem, which the Roshi has assigned. What is the sound of one hand? Who were you before your father and mother conceived you? When Joshu was asked, does a dog have Buddha nature? He replied, no. What is the meaning of no, or move? All sorts of these problems. And so as time goes on, every day the student goes to the teacher for what is called sanzen. Sanzen means studying Zen. And he has to present a satisfactory answer to the koan. Now sanzen is the moment in the monastery when no holds are barred. Although there's a very formal approach to it. The monk has to stop outside the master's quarters and make this mokugyo. He does that three times. And at a signal from the master, which is ringing a bell in reply, he goes in and sits down in front of the master and bows right down to the floor and then sits up. And he repeats the koan that he's been given. And he's supposed to answer it. Now the master, if he's not satisfied with the answer, may simply ring his bell, which means interview over, nothing doing. Or if he's still not satisfied, he may try to do something to hint the student as to which way to go, or puzzle him further, some sort of comment. But what happens is this. Do you see what kind of a situation has been set up here? The student is really being asked to be absolutely genuine. So if I said to you, now don't be self-conscious. I want you to be perfectly sincere. And as a matter of fact, I'm a mind reader. And I know whether you're being sincere or not. I can see right down to that last little wiggly guzzle in the back of your mind. And if you think I can, you see, I'm putting you in a double bind. I'm commanding you to be genuine. How can you possibly do that on command? Especially when the person you're confronted with is a father figure, an authority figure. And in Japan, the sensei, the teacher, is even a more authoritative figure than one's father, which is saying a lot. But you are being asked in the presence of this tiger to be completely spontaneous. Or it isn't put in that way, you see, though. I mean, I'm describing this from the standpoint of a psychologist observing what's going on here. No, the thing you've got to do is you've got to hear the sound of one hand. And as your answers become more and more rejected, you get more and more desperate. And there is built up the state that is called the great doubt. The students do everything, you know. They've read all the old Zen stories, and they come in with pieces of rock and wood, and they try and hit the teacher. They do everything they get. Nothing will do. I remember I had a friend studying in Kyoto, and on the way to the master's quarters, you pass through a lovely garden with a pool, and he saw a bullfrog in the garden. And he grabbed this bullfrog, they're very tame in Japan, nobody eats them, and put it in the sleeve of his kimono. And when he got in to give an answer to his koan, he produced the bullfrog. And the master shook his head and said, mm-mm, too intellectual. Of course, he meant not so much what we mean by intellectual, but too contrived, too premeditated. You know, you're just copying other people's Zen antics. And that's something you just can't get away with. Well, there does come a critical point of total desperation. And when the student reaches that point, the teacher really starts encouraging him. He says, now, come on, you're getting warm. But you must die, be ready to die for this. You must, students have even been put under into the position that if they don't get it in so many days, they're going to commit suicide. And they have to stimulate this intense period, a thing called osession. Don't confuse the word session with the English session. Session means studying or observation of the shin, the heart, the mind. The heart-mind. And at this time, they only sleep 4 hours a night. And they meditate solidly all through the day. They go for the sanzen interview twice a day, every one of them. And it's a tremendous workout and will last about 5 days. 5 or 6 days. And in that period, the pressure is really on. Everybody is worked into a pitch of this kind of psychic fury that they have to get this thing answered. There's a man in Japan today who has a 5-day Zen system, and he practically guarantees that you will have Satori in his 5 days. I've just got a book about it written by a Britisher. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. Well, I had a someone I knew of who was over studying Zen on a Fulbright grant, and the grant was winding up, and he still hadn't got the sound of one hand. And he said to the master, "Look, a grant's running out, and I can't stay here, and I've just got to get this thing." So just the day before he left, he suddenly realized that there was nothing to realize. And that was it. You know, here he had spent his whole life thinking that there's something deficient in me. See, there's something wrong. Something I ought to find out to get this problem of life cleaned up. Well, you know what you do. Rinzai, the old Chinese master, said, Zen teaching is like using an empty fist to deceive a child. Or like trying to stop a child crying by giving it a yellow leaf. See, the child wants gold. And so you give it an autumn leaf and say, "Dear darling, there's some gold. Be all right." Or with your closed fist, you say, "What have I got here?" The child comes and tries to see and pull your fingers open, then you hide it behind your back and under your leg and behind the chair. Child gets absolutely fascinated. The longer you keep this up, the more the child is sure there's something real goody inside the hand. And then at the end, psst, nothing. And that's Zen. So there comes the time, you see, when the student can go in front of the master and not give a damn. Because he's seen the point. There wasn't a problem. He made up the problem himself. He came and projected it on this master, who knew how to handle that kind of person, by making him much more stupid than he was before. Until he sees the essential stupidity of the human situation, where we are playing a game of one-upmanship on other people and on the universe. How to get the better of life? Well, what makes you think you're separate from life so that you can get the better of it? How can you beat the game? What game? Or who will beat it? This illusion of beating the game, of finding the thing out, of catching it by the tail, is therefore dissipated by the technique of the koan. It's called, working on a koan is like a mosquito biting an iron bull. It's the nature of the mosquito to bite. It's the nature of an iron bull to be unbitten. Or they say it's like swallowing a ball of molten lead. You can't swallow it down. You can't cough it up. You can't get rid of this thing. That's the great doubt, you see. But this is an exaggerated form of what everybody is ordinarily trying to do to beat the game. So at that moment, the student has heard the sound of one hand, or discovered who he was before father and mother conceived him, or what no means. So the teacher says, "Good. Now, you have found the frontier gate to Zen. You've put your foot in at the door. and you're across the threshold. But there's a long way to go. And now you have found this priceless thing out, you must redouble your efforts. So he gives him another koan. Now the student may be able to answer that one instantly, because it's simply a test koan. See, there are five classes of koans. And the first class is what you call the Hinayana koans, and the other four are the Mahayana koans. Hinayana is to reach nirvana. Mahayana is to come back and bring nirvana into the world as a bodhisattva. So once you get the great void, you see, there's nothing to catch on to. You are the universe. It doesn't matter whether you live or die. That's nirvana. All clinging to life, everything like that, you see then that it's hopeless. And you give it up, because not because you know that you think you ought to give it up, because you know there is no way of catching it. There's nothing to catch hold of. There's no safety in the cosmos. So you just have to give up. Then, the next class of koans are such things as asking for miracles. In that class comes, take the four divisions of Tokyo out of your sleeve. Or stop the booming of a distant bell. Blow out a candle in Timbuktu. So, but as they go on in various ways, they are concerned with all kinds of problems and how Zen understanding deals with those problems. Until we get in the end to the study of morality and rules of social and monastic life. That's the last thing. And the Zen way of understanding it. Now, this takes very, very differing periods of time. Some people get through in as little as 10 years, the whole thing. There is a very brilliant Westerner by the name of Walter Novick who has just about completed the whole thing. And he's a musician and a pianist. And he'll come back to this country as the first accredited Zen master of the West. And he'll set up his little sodo in New England, Vermont or somewhere, and on a farm, and wait and see what happens. But so the day of graduation comes, and then everybody turns out, and there's a great hullabaloo, and they salute the departing monk, and he goes out. He may just become a layman, as I said, or become a temple priest, or he may be himself a Roshi. Well, now, the essential of this whole system, as you see, is to use a hair of the dog that bit you for the cure of the bite. It's homeopathic. When people are under delusion, they cannot be talked out of the delusion. No amount of talk could persuade anybody that his ego is an illusion. Because he knows it's there. He knows I am I. And simply won't believe you if you tell him that this is nothing but post-hypnotic suggestion. So the only way to convince a fool of his folly is to make him persist in it. As Blake says, the fool who persists in his folly will become wise. By some psychiatrists I know who when they get a person who overeats and is tremendously fat, the first thing they do is they make them put on 15 more pounds. And get an alcoholic terribly drunk. Oh, and sick and just as awful as could be, you see. Really make him go at it. See, that's a method that's used. Sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. It's a rather desperate method. Rather dangerous method. Zen is dangerous too. People could easily go crazy under this sort of strain without a good advisor. Well, it is clear, of course, that this method of Zen training is most unsuited to the modern age. And this is witnessed, too, by the fact that the temples are relatively empty. Myoshinji, the biggest one in Kyoto, is built to house 600 monks. There are only 80. And you might think that was quite a crowd, but it isn't, compared with the old days. To young people in Japan today, this is all incomprehensible. They see no point in it. A few, yes, but they are mostly clergy sons carrying out the family tradition. And that's very bad indeed, to be sent to a monastery virtually. As though the only possible success can come for someone who goes because he feels that nothing else in the world will satisfy him. He just has to do it. And so the traditions, as in all these ancient organizations, have become very fixed. A lot of it's meaningless. It is certainly not going to last, not in that form. It's falling apart right under our eyes. It's old and it's set in its ways. Also, since the time of Hakuin, the koans have been given fixed answers. That is to say, there is a sort of prescribed way in which to answer, and you've got to hit on the right one. And then after you've answered it, you have to find a poem from a little book called the Zen Rinkushu, which means the Zen Forest Anthology. And there are little couplets, and you've got to find one which represents the meaning of your koan. I mean, you know, take the four divisions of Tokyo out of your sleeve. Nothing could be simpler. But some monk has recently threatened to publish all the answers to the koans. So that the masters would have to get on their toes and invent new ones. I know a Roshi who invents new ones. He pounces on all his students, or college students, and he pounces on them with, what's the first letter in the dictionary? Things like that. And the moment they open their mouths, he stops them. No, too late. You know, he says, you could ask a Christian, what's the first word in the Bible? And things like that. It becomes much more lively, you see, when there is this quick interchange of the teacher and the students. But in modern idiom, who the devil wants to know about Joshu's moo anymore? Or some ancient fellow's questions, couched in language, incidentally. This is part of the problems they have. The language of these koans is very archaic. I mean, what is the sound of one hand? Well, there's a Chinese proverb which says, one hand won't make a clap. So if you don't know that proverb, if that proverb is in everyday use, and I say to you, what is the sound of one hand? Then it has some sense. But there are all kinds of references, allusions in the old stories and they therefore don't necessarily fit our world or the Japanese world of today. You have to take the koans out of everyday life, things that are going on now, you see. I mean, it's like asking, what's that man who advertises Schweppes, Commander Whitehead? Why has Commander Whitehead no beard? So, there was, though, you see, there was a division in the history of Zen. There was a critical point in the 17th century when there were two very great masters, Hakuin and Bankei. Now, the 17th century is tremendously important in Japanese history because that was a time when, of what you might call the democratization of culture. Basho invented haiku poetry so that everyone could be a poet. Not necessarily for publication, but for one's own fun. People didn't write poems for publication necessarily. They wrote poems for parties. And he invented the 17-syllable haiku as a result of his Zen feeling for nature, so that he could put this within the reach of everybody. What had happened to poetry before that time was that it had become so obscure and so effete and so sophisticated that only great literati could do it at all. This happened to Chinese poetry. There were so many references to other poems. It was like reading T.S. Eliot. You know, in the Four Quartets. You could get an annotated Four Quartets showing you the sources of all the phrases he's borrowed. And sometimes you have to know the source in order to see what he means by it. And all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. All right, that's straight from the Revelations of the Divine Love by Dame Julian of Norwich. But whoever would know that? And you have to understand the scene she was digging in order to know really what Eliot's getting at in that all shall be well. And he's full of that. He quotes the Bhagavad Gita. He quotes everybody. Well, this is so if we all had to write that way, nobody could be a poet unless he was a great scholar. So Basho made up, he popularized the haiku, and the haiku are originally based on the Zenrin poems. They take their flavor from that. There is one, you see, that bird calls, mountain changes to be more mysterious. The first line of that says, the wind drops, but the flowers keep on falling. The bird calls and the mountain becomes more mysterious. And so haiku developed from that kind of short insight, that glimpse of nature. Now, while Basho was taking poetry to the peasants, Bankei was taking Zen to them as well, to the farmers. And he ran his Zen on an entirely different system. He talked mainly about what he called Hushō. Hushō is the unborn, that which has not yet arisen and which, as a matter of fact, never does arise. And so he said, there is in you the unborn mind which was given to you by your parents. Let me just read you a few quotations from him to show you what sort of a person he was. The mind begotten by and given to each of us by our parents is none other than the Buddha mind, birthless and immaculate, sufficient to manage all that life throws upon us. A proof. Suppose at this very instant, while you face me listening, a crow caws and a sparrow twitters somewhere behind you. Without any intention on your part to distinguish between these sounds, you hear each distinctly. In doing so, you are hearing with the birthless mind, which is yours for all eternity. Well, we are to be in this mind from now on, and our sect will be known as the Buddha Mind Sect. To consider my example of a moment ago once again, if any of you feel you heard the crow and the sparrow intentionally, you are deluding yourselves. for you are listening to me, not to what goes on behind you. In spite of this, there are moments when you hear such sounds distinctly, when you hear with the Buddha mind of non-birth. Nobody here can deny this. All of you are living Buddhas because the birthless mind which each possesses is the beginning and the basis of all. Now, if the Buddha mind is birthless, it is necessarily immortal, for how can what has never been born perish? You've all encountered the phrase birthless and imperishable in the sutras, not born, not dying. You know? But hitherto you've not had the slightest proof of its truth. Indeed, I suppose, like most people, you've memorized this phrase while being ignorant of the fact of birthlessness. When I was 25, I realized that non-birth is all sufficient to life, and since then, for 40 years, I've been proving it to people just like you. I was the first to preach this greatest truth of life. I ask, have any of you priests heard anybody else teach this truth before me? Of course not. A priest said to him, once in the Buddha mind, I'm absent-minded. Bankei says, well, suppose you're absent-minded as you say. If someone pricked you in the back with a gimlet, would you feel the pain? Naturally. Then you are not absent-minded. Feeling the pain, your mind would show itself to be alert. A layman says, though I undertake Zen discipline, I often find myself lazy, weary of the whole thing, unable to advance. And he replies, once in the Buddha mind, there's no need to advance, nor is it possible to recede. Once in birthlessness, to attempt to advance is to have receded from the state of non-birth. A man secure in that state need not bother himself with such things. He's above them. The Buddha mind in each of you is immaculate. All you've done is reflected in it. But if you bother about one such reflection, you're certain to go astray. Your thoughts don't lie deep enough. They rise from the shallows of your mind. Remember that all you see and hear is reflected in the Buddha mind and influenced by what was previously seen and heard. Needless to say, thoughts aren't entities. So if you permit them to rise, reflect themselves, or cease altogether as they are prone to do, and if you don't worry about them, you'll never go astray. In this way, let 100, nay 1,000 thoughts arise, and it's as if not one has arisen. You will remain undisturbed. The only thing I tell my people is to stay in the Buddha mind. There are no regulations, no formal discipline. Nevertheless, they have agreed among themselves to sit in Zen for a period of 2 incense sticks daily. All right, let them. But they should well understand that the birthless Buddha mind has absolutely nothing to do with sitting with an incense stick burning in front of you. If one keeps in the Buddha mind without straying, there's no further Satori to seek. Whether awake or asleep, one is a living Buddha. Zazen means only one thing, sitting tranquilly in the Buddha mind. But really, you know, one's everyday life in its entirety should be thought of as a kind of sitting in Zen. Even during one's formal sitting, one may leave one's seat to attend to something. In my temple, at least, such things are allowed. Indeed, it's sometimes advisable to walk in Zen for one incense stick burning and sit in Zen for the other. A natural thing after all. One can't sleep all day, so one rises. One can't talk all day, so one sits in Zen. There are no binding rules here. And so that's what happened, you see. Bankei was the abbot of Myoshinji, the Roshi. And he stopped the monks using the kaiseki stick to hit them when they weren't meditating or sleeping in meditation, because he said, even a sleeping man is still a Buddha, and you shouldn't be disrespectful. And he attempted a Zen of no methods. You can meditate if you want to, that's fine. But that's like polishing a brick to make a mirror. And he used to say, too, that trying to purify your mind is like trying to wash off blood with blood. But Bankei Zen was elusive. Hakuin had 80 successors. Bankei had none. And some people think that that was the most admirable thing about it.